is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, May 12, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio just north of New York City. Well, today we're going to begin what we are going to refer to as Broadcasters Week. Today we start with Dan Shulman, who has backstories about what we refer to as the Bin Laden game. He was doing play-by-play on Sunday Night Baseball the moment that the news of Osama bin Laden's death broke. He's got a lot of other stories as well, but we start with this. Major League Baseball owners have given MLB the go-ahead to make a proposal to the players' union that would lead to the season starting around the July 4th weekend in ballparks without fans. This is according to Jeff Passan's sources. A meeting between Major League Baseball and the players' union is set for Tuesday and is expected to be a contentious negotiation since owners will call for an unprecedented 50-50 revenue split with players. The union is expected to reject that part of the plan. This is Tony Clark's statement to The Athletic. This is not the first salary cap proposal our union has received. It probably won't be the last. Some other parts of the proposal, you'll see an expanded playoff field potentially from 10 to 14 teams, an 82-game season, a universal DH, a second spring training starting in June, and geographic schedules in which teams play only opponents in a similar area. If any ballpark is not available because state or local officials have not approved resuming play, Manfred has told owners he is prepared to move that team to another city to play home games. There was a lot of back and forth about this yesterday. I have strong feelings about the way this is playing out. We'll be talking about that in a moment with Jesse Rogers. Sources told Enrique Rojas that the cancellation of the World Baseball Classic in 2021 is imminent. One source saying it's not a priority right now. Before we get to Dan Shulman and Jesse Rogers, if you want more of the MLB's plan being presented to the players, check out today's episode of ESPN Daily. Jeff Passan tells Mina Kimes what's happening, what's going on. Then later, Jeff talks with Nelson Cruz of the Minnesota Twins about how he's been waiting out the pandemic. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Jesse Rogers covers baseball for ESPN. And Jesse, based on what you've heard, what's been the reaction on the player side to that leaked out proposal that we heard about yesterday?
Well, first off, they're not thrilled that any of this has leaked or as much of these scenarios have leaked out over the months. I mean, on one side, it's just talk. It's just fodder. On the other side, you know what happens when these things leak. All of a sudden, the texts and the calls start going back and forth. And you know, I talked to Andrew Miller and Chris Iannetta over the weekend about this, and they're on the executive board. And they just feel like there's just been too much out in the public. And, of course, now we finally have a definitive proposal that is out there. And they're okay with the games played and the travel and all that. They still don't know exactly how they're going to stay safe and keep their coaches safe and their umpires safe and everybody around them safe, their families when they go back home. They haven't heard that just yet. And obviously they are sort of ready for a big time negotiation when it comes to the compensation angle of it all, Buster. I did get a hold of some talking points that players are going to use when they discuss these things with the league. If you want me to go through a few of them for you.
Yeah. Yep.
And this all has to do with compensation. First and foremost, and this boggles my mind that they can't even agree on this. The fact that the players think they decided this in the previous agreement at the beginning of the season, that they would be forwarded that $170 million. And then if they play, that would be an advance. Remember, that's not just free money. That's an advance on their paycheck. And then if they play, it'll be a prorated full salary. They think it's been negotiated. The owners say no. It boggles my mind that both sides can't even agree on what they agreed upon at the end of March, early April there. So that's number one they're going to argue. Number two is obviously that they've already given up 50% of their salary. That's obvious. Number three, and this is one of the most important points, is the idea that they are not a salary cap league, that they do not get extra revenues to the player. The players don't when baseball revenues increase, and they don't think they should have to deal with the losses when they play without fans this year. They feel like, hey, there are years where you guys make more money. We don't see it. This is one year where you're not going to make as much money. We feel we shouldn't have to take the brunt of that. And then the league may claim that this is the only possible way to have a season if the players take an additional reduction. Well, according to the players' data, the players' financial data, they don't see it that way. They believe owners will still turn a profit without fans in the stands while still paying prorated full salaries to the players. So those are the talking points they're going to make to the league. Now, again, that, there might be a difference in financial data. One side says, no, we're going to lose money. The other side says, no, the extra postseason teams will help you. You can pay us even without fans and still be okay. So that's what's going to happen as soon as maybe today.
I want to double back on, you mentioned about the safety concerns, and that's what your story over the weekend really focused on from your conversations with Andrew Miller and with Chris Iannetta. And I heard this a lot from agents last night, that while a lot of the conversation on Monday was about the financial terms between the two sides, ultimately, it's going to come down to how those questions about maintaining safety are going to be answered. I would encourage everybody to go to Sean Doolittle's Twitter feed, because he sent out a number of questions, and I think that those will reflect a lot of the conversation that the players are going to want to have. What did you learn in talking with those two guys?
Well, one thing I learned, not necessarily from them, but I did learn yesterday, and this isn't anything even, you know, you could write down on paper just yet, but think of it as a general sort of idea, is that players and maybe others, I only heard about players, would get tested three times a week. So that's kind of a starting point. Now, again, none of this has sort of leaked from the proposal. I have a feeling, Buster, they don't know exactly what it's going to look like today, but they will in a month. I think that, I mean, the reason we don't have details on the safety issue is I don't think they know exactly what they're going to do right now, because the world's going to look different in a month. But there's no doubt that there are questions about guys with underlying conditions, and their big point is the people around them. They understand most of their guy, other than being, you know, maybe sidelined from their team, they feel like, okay, we're young, we're going to be okay. And I've used that in quotes because, you know, young people can get severely sick too. But it is those umpires, it is those coaches, it is those managers, a lot of them who are older. It is going back to their families. And so just to say something positive, I do think they like the concept of this plan, other than, you know, rather than being quarantined in Florida or Arizona. I think they like the centralized travel and things like that. But they still don't have answers on safety, worried about guys with diabetes and asthma. They did wonder about, you know, guys like Anthony Rizzo or John Lester with cancer, you know, maybe a decade ago. But from what I've heard, that may not be a big issue. Obviously, if you're going through if you went through chemo recently, that's a different story. But asthma and diabetes are big question marks as well. And I don't know the answers to those. And again, it's just, right now, it's a broad outline in terms of safety, something I heard yesterday, maybe players getting tested three times a week.
Yeah, part of the problem on this whole issue of safety, Jesse, is that it does feel like the context changes every hour. And I know that among agents I've spoken with, among some players, you know, part of their questions are, okay, how are we going to get the data about where the hotspots are, where the numbers of infections have gone up? How are we going to monitor that? And those are things that constantly shift. You know, the question of testing and how you have access to that. Those are things that seem to be constantly shifting. I do think, and I'm curious if you have the same sense from talking with players, is that whatever plan they come up with, I think they also have to account for the players who say, you know what, I'm not interested in doing that. That to me, whether a family situation, an underlying health condition, there are going to be players who are basically going to decline. Now, some of them might be in a position where they've made the bulk of their money in their careers. You know, given the uncertainty of the situation, wouldn't surprise me if they were to go, I'm just not going to participate. And then the question comes in, what do you do with their contracts? You know, do they get service time for this year, like was negotiated earlier this year? Is their contract subject to being voided, which under typical circumstances, if a player refused to report, you know, that would be possible. They would have to certainly negotiate exceptions for that. Again, have you heard, or do you feel the same way that I do, that there will be at least some players who will say, you know what, that it's just too problematic for me to participate?
Definitely a possibility. I mean, we're talking about 1,200 players in the middle of a situation that's unheard of, right? I mean, we've never come across something like this before. And there's absolutely differing opinions. I mean, over the course of these 2 months, I've talked to players that just are on opposite ends. Just yesterday, I had a couple players sort of push back on even their executive board and just said, let's get out there. Let's go. I mean, you know, obviously they want to hear the good answers about safety, but they're more willing to sort of push it than other players. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, I talked to two veterans, and they didn't say this exactly the same way, but they were both veterans who had made a lot of money. One was like, you know what? What you just said, I could wait a year. I mean, why fudge this and manipulate it and just, you know, have any risks at all? I could wait a year. The other was like, I'm kind of towards the end of my career. I just, let's get out there. I want to get out there. I don't know. Maybe it's my last year, that kind of talk. Those were two kind of similar players with differing viewpoints. And I think you're going to get that up and down. I mean, definitely the younger single guys, that kind of stuff. Let's go. I'm ready. A bunch of them that are still in Arizona or Florida, I feel like are in that mode. Let's go. A lot of them that have gone home, I feel like are a little bit more like, okay, let's get this right. Otherwise, let's just cancel and go to 2021. So you're exactly right. There's so many different viewpoints on this thing. And I mean, I really haven't been in touch with the guys that, maybe the Latin American guys that might have a completely different viewpoint that, you know, I'm not even sure on that end of things. So there's going to be some pushback, but ultimately I think the players will be unified by the fact that they're not necessarily going to like everything they hear from the league. So they're probably going to fight the league first and then maybe have some internal discussions about all of this stuff.
And I got to say, this thing is so complicated and it's so fragile. And as I say, the context changes from day to day according to the, you know, the health conditions in a state or in a city. I cannot believe that these two sides let this get public in the way that it has. I think they've lost their friggin' minds. On the owners,
players,
on both sides. I cannot believe that it's this public. Obviously on owner's side yesterday, I cannot believe the details of their proposal leaked before they actually got it into the hands of the players. And let's face it, that probably was done at least in some corners, perhaps to bully the players in public opinion. Look, here's our offer. We're going to give them 50%. And, you know, at a time when so many people are out of jobs, the players have an opportunity to make a lot of money. And so the fact that that was handled in that way is so old school and, in my opinion, so inappropriate. And on the other side, on the player side, you know, to have Tony Clark and Scott Boras come out issuing statements and drawing negotiating lines in the sand, that helps nobody. Shut up. Get into a room. Talk through your problems. This is not a classic CBA negotiation. The context is so different because of all the job losses, because of all the financial losses, because of all the lives that are lost. People do not want to hear about a public fight over money between owners and players. There needs to be collaboration. They need to get a committee together where they run through all the potential issues. You know, someone like Andrew Miller or Sean Doolittle can speak for the players' behalf about questions about health concerns. They can talk through the financial issues. The owners basically can show the players, okay, this is what we have. But to have all this public conversation and talk about a salary cap, oh, stop. It's not a salary cap. It's a one-year way to deal with a tremendous loss of finances on the owner's side. And if the two sides actually want to get something together and play baseball this year, they better figure out how to work together and do it behind closed doors and come up in an agreement that way. Sorry for grabbing the microphone that way. I'm appalled by what's happened. What do you think?
Oh, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. I mean, I think this is why, and I think the players feel like they're just always behind the eight ball, just fighting, you know, fighting the machine a little bit, so to speak. I think this is why Iannetta and Andrew Miller went on the record with me just days before this proposal became public. I think they want to get their point out there, but you're not wrong. I mean, I think people are like, okay, Scott Boras with the op-eds and all this public rhetoric from him is just enough on that end. And And I think there's some animosity there that, okay, save that for the CBA negotiations. We are trying to get through a unique year. I have always been a little bit, like most people, sort of on the player's side when these issues come up, right? It's just kind of natural to be on their side a lot of times. And I probably am ultimately here, but you're not wrong. It's like, take this behind closed doors and get it done. Again, back to my original point. How can they have not decided whether this has been agreed upon or not? How can they actually come out of that late March, early April discussion and say, one side says this is done, we're getting our prorated full salaries. The other side says, no, this is still open for discussion. That boggles my mind right there, that they haven't even decided if this has been decided.
And I got to tell you, Jesse, the way this is playing out, first, you and I both know that because the players are on the front line, they're the ones in front of the stands. When this is over and fans go back into the stands, the players are the ones who are going to take the brunt of this. When, you know, Tony Clark, Scott Boras put out statements, when the owners leaked it the way they did on Monday, that does, the backlash comes down on the players, and it also hurts the product. Because, I mean, you see it, I see it on the social media feeds, reaction to these public fight over money. You have fans basically saying a pox on all their on both their houses.
Along those lines, I forgot to mention my sixth and final point from the player side is that they are the ones taking the risk, as you just said, the safety and health risk. And I've heard people push back on that, like, wait a minute, I've been furloughed. What you know, the whole millionaires thing, you know, why they're whining. But wait a minute, if you've been furloughed and they ask you to go back to work and take a health risk, you are going to expect your full pay. You've already missed half your salary as you've been furloughed, kind of like the players. Now they ask you to go back to work and take a risk. You're going to want your pay. And that's what the players are facing. You're asking us to go back to work at 50% salary, take a health risk for the people around us, and cut us more. That argument absolutely rings true to me. Like, that's a very good argument. We're asking you to be the country's entertainment, and we're all going to be safe watching you guys. And we want you to take a little bit more of a pay cut. That makes a lot of sense to me. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I mean, the bottom line is that if there's going to be baseball this year, the two sides have to work together. And yesterday and the events of yesterday and the public statements and the leaking is the first indication that, for me, as I went to bed last night, I was more discouraged about the possibility of baseball than I had been at any time before, because of the way the two sides are working with each other. All right, Jesse, thanks for doing it. Hang in there.
All right, you got it. I will talk soon, Buster. Take care.
Dan Shulman was the voice of Sunday Night Baseball for 7 years and a great teammate, and he continues to do play-by-play for ESPN Radio and for television and for the Toronto Blue Jays. And Dan, great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, Buster. I hope you and your family are doing okay. I'd love to see your face, but we're not Zooming. We're podcasting, but hearing your voice is the next best thing.
Yeah, that's really polite, and I know now that you're lying, especially because I had that brutal self-haircut that I did last week. I know what your advice would be. Just cut it all off.
You know what? Actually, this is one of the few times where the bald guys are saying, we win. Like, for better or for worse, I look exactly the same as I always do, because every 2 days I shave my head. So once this is all over, I'll show you how to do it properly if you want it. So you'll cut yourself a couple of times, then you'll toughen up and you'll be fine.
No, you'll appreciate this, because the other day after I went on television and I talked about the problem that I had with my hair last week, when I caught up with a set of clippers up the right side of my head, and then I realized, Dan, that I hadn't put the guard on. And yeah, so that was ugly, and I wound up looking like a dictator from North Korea. You know, I could be a body double right now if I wanted to, and I got a text from our friend Aaron Boone. He goes, man, what happened there? And I said, yeah, I look like, you know, the North Korean dictator. And he texted back in sort of classic Booney fashion. You know who you look like? You look like the dictator from North Korea. I'm like, Booney, that's what I just texted you.
Well, so Aaron's a little off his needling game during the pandemic as well. He's usually sharper than that.
Yeah, exactly. That's, he was like, Aaron, oof, with the response.
yeah, next time, Buster, start in the back. If you make a mistake in the back, it's not as noticeable. Don't start on the side.
Let me tell you, my two kids, one's 20 years old, one is 15. They're thrilled with how bad it looks. They absolutely love it. All right, thanks for joining us for storytelling. You sent me some notes. I'm working from my notes. And we start with this. I had forgotten that you did the Steve Bartman game on ESPN Radio. What do you got? What are your memories about that game?
Well, the first thing I remember, and you'll be able to visualize this, if you're up on the level of the broadcast booths at Wrigley Field, and you go out to the back part where you get the notes or where the media eats, or if you walk to the ramps that go up and down, you can look out and see Wrigleyville below. The Cubs were up 3-2 on the Marlins. There were all kinds of uniformed officers on horses, and 3 hours before the game, Buster, there were thousands of people at Wrigleyville, thousands, and it was like Mardi Gras. They thought it was over, and why not? They had Mark Pryor going in Game 6 and Kerry Wood going in Game 7, and they were at home, and they were ready to move on to the World Series, and it was like a party. And they're leading 3-0 going to the 8th inning, and if memory serves, I think there was one out and one on when Luis Castillo came up, and he hits, you know the story, hit the fly ball down the left field line. Moises Alou comes over, jumps, in my judgment, reaches into the stands. Bartman touches the ball. Alou doesn't catch it, and the Marlins score 8 runs, win the game, win the series, et cetera, et cetera. But in the moment in which it happened, right at that moment, it was as if all of the air got sucked out of the balloon. All the oxygen went out of the ballpark, and it was like you were in a vacuum. You couldn't hear anything. And the first thought that came to me was, oh, so this is how it's going to happen this time. And I think every Cub fan immediately, like, sobered up and said, oh, you got to be kidding me. And the Marlins go on, you know, there's the ground ball that the play isn't made, and then Mordecai doubles up the alley and scores 3, and we know what happens. But, I've never seen, ever, in 25 years of doing baseball and basketball, I've never seen the energy change quicker in a ballpark than in that moment in 2003 at Wrigley Field.
Because they expected the worst to happen, right? I mean,
instantly.
And let me ask you this. In the moment that it happened, did you anticipate that there would be the level of scrutiny of Steve Bartman that there turned out to be?
Not in that moment, but it wasn't long after where we saw him being, and I don't want to use escorted in the wrong sense, like he wasn't dragged out of there. He was, for his own benefit, he was accompanied, maybe that's a better word, accompanied by a couple of people, security people from the ballpark, if I'm remembering correctly. We didn't know where he was going, but, you know, the camera was on him. I was doing ESPN Radio, but I assume Fox was the network, the TV network there. So the camera was on him constantly, like between every pitch. And you could see the look on his face. You could see how horrified he was that he had been involved in this. And then some security personnel from the ballpark came and accompanied him out of his seat down a tunnel, and we didn't see him again for the rest of that night. So in that moment, no. A minute or two later, yes. And again, because it was the Cubs and because they hadn't won since 1908, et cetera, et cetera. So there was just so much on the line, and you felt terrible for him. And I continue to feel terrible for him. Here's a guy who went to the ballpark, as big a Cub fan probably as anybody around. And if you look at photos or videos again and you watch other people, a dozen people are reaching for the ball. Fate just found him. And it's all a little bit better now, of course, because they won the World Series in 2016. That didn't do any people, from 2003 to 2016, unfortunately, a lot of, lifelong Cub fans, may have not lived long enough to see the World Series in 2016, but it does get a little bit better with them having won. But it was crazy. I've been fortunate is the right word, but I've been there for some crazy stuff on and off the field in both of the sports, field court, in both of the sports that I do, but that one is right up near the top of the list.
I didn't realize how bad it was going to be until when I was reading stories online that night that were published in the major papers in Chicago, when I saw that they not only published his name, but they published where he lived.
Oh, and I didn't know that.
I immediately, as a journalist, I was like, oh my God, this poor guy moving forward is going to have so much on him. I've always respected the fact that, despite, I'm sure, plenty of requests from ESPN and other news outlets, he's maintained his private space when the Cubs wanted to invite him back to give him a championship ring. After they won in 2016, he never changed that stance.
Yeah, I respect that, too. And I don't look, you know, I don't look online to see if you can Google him and find, like, does he, you know, does he go to the grocery store? Does he go to the movies? Does he go to the mall? Does he play in a softball league? I don't know the answer to any of those questions. I just hope he's able to live somewhat of a normal life. You know, you used to read years ago, he grew a beard. He changed his appearance a little bit. I hope that anybody who bumps into him, who recognizes him, is you know, doesn't take it out on him. The vast majority of people would have done exactly the same thing that Steve Bartman did.
All right. May 1st, 2011, you and I were in Philadelphia. Bobby Valentine was working Sunday Night Baseball with you with John Kruk. That's known as the Bin Laden game, because in the midst of that broadcast from Citizens Bank Park, you got news. And I don't know if you remember this, but I had left the game about three innings before this happened. I had jury duty the next morning. And so Mike McQuaid, who was overseeing baseball for ESPN, said, yeah, go ahead. You can leave about the seventh inning and we'll take the broadcast from there. And then after I left, as I was listening to the game on the radio, that's when the news broke that Bin Laden had been killed.
I did not remember that part. So that, as you know, was both of our first years on Sunday Night Baseball, 2011. And we, as you say, we're in Philadelphia. They're playing the Mets. And I remember it was the seventh or eighth inning. But again, you know, there's some things they don't teach you how to do when you're learning how to do this job. And this falls under, this was one of them. Bobby was sitting beside me, and Bobby nudged me with his elbow and just showed me his phone. And it was a text. And all it said was, we got Bin Laden. Now, we're on the air. This is during the game. It's not on a commercial break. And I don't remember ever looking to see who the text was from. I don't know who it was from. Never did. And I, you know, I'm sure my eyes got wide. Bobby looked at me. I looked at him, you know, and then another pitch comes in. Like, we're doing a baseball game here. So you call the pitch. And then what I did is I went on TalkBack, which for the listeners who don't know means I can talk to the people in the truck. I went on talk without it going out over the air. And I said to Tom Archer, our producer at the time, I said, do you guys have anything on Bin Laden? And meanwhile, another pitch comes in. And Arch goes, yes, we're trying to corroborate. Don't say anything yet. So for about 30, 45, 60 seconds, we call the game. And Arch and Claire Smith from our editorial team as well, Hall of Famer Claire Smith, was in the truck. And they started kind of guiding me, again, because I didn't have any information, didn't have a computer open, I don't think, watching the ball game. And they told me, you know, gave me very basic facts and told me to report those on the air. And so we did. And then, of course, the game went like 13 innings or something. So we were on the air for about 2 hours after this news broke. But the thing I remember the most, Buster, is within 2 minutes, because of phones, everybody in the ballpark knew what was going on. And this spontaneous, deafening chant of USA, USA broke out in the ballpark. I've always said it always reminded me of like 1980 Lake Placid, a USA hockey game, like that kind of fervor, but even more, I think. And this was 45,000 people. And so for the next 2 hours, it was kind of a baseball game and kind of the biggest event going on in the world. And Mike Tirico, a good friend of mine, texted me during an inning break and he said, hey, don't forget that you are in the spot right now with the largest gathering of Americans anywhere in the world. And if you think about it, he was right.
Wow.
Sunday Night Baseball, there was no other major sporting event going on, 42,000 people, whatever, in Philadelphia, a lot of Met fans, a lot of New Yorkers down there. And that was great context and perspective from Mike. And he said, where you are is part of the story. And the crowd became part of the story. And eventually the players found out. They were the last people to find out what was going on. And for the next 2 hours, it was the most surreal experience, I think, of my career. Because again, I didn't know how to do this. They don't, you know, we don't cover this one in our seminars. And if I had a do over, I would do some things differently. But I also think, Buster, candidly, I was even more nervous maybe than I should have been, because I'm Canadian. I'm not American. And I wanted to be incredibly careful that I didn't say anything wrong or that could be misconstrued in any way. So I'll tell you, having Bobby there was great, because, of course, he was the manager of the Mets at the time of 9/11 back in 2001. And he was so helpful to me getting through those next few innings.
I was just going to say that you and I – you know, we worked with a lot of different people on Sunday Night Baseball. We had Bobby Valentine. We had Terry Francona, John Kruk, Curt Schilling. And of everybody, you couldn't have picked somebody better than Bobby. I'm guessing through that whole broadcast, he's probably continued to show you his phone, because Bobby knows a lot of people, as you know, in law enforcement.
Yes, he does. Bobby knows a lot of people. And I'll tell you, Bobby, like I said, Bobby, he carried it the rest of the way. And I'll forever be indebted to Bobby Valentine for that, because I probably got a little wide-eyed for a few minutes, and it may not have come out in my voice over the air, but Bobby just went into full, like, manager mode, crisis control mode, I got this mode, and he was great. You know, we talked about 9/11, we talked about what was going on now. Bobby is, well, as you know, Buster, he is well-versed in many, many, many subjects, and he was fantastic that night.
All right, later that year, you had what I've told you this in the past, one of the best calls I ever heard. David Freese had that incredible Game 6 performance in the World Series.
Freese leading it off, crowd in a frenzy. 3-2, a swing and a high fly ball, center field, it is gone! David Freese, who tied it in the ninth, wins it in the 11th in one of the most remarkable, improbable baseball games you will ever see. And there's going to be baseball here in St. Louis, Game 7, tomorrow night.
What do you remember about that night?
I remember a lot about that night. So I get asked a fair bit, you know, on radio shows, podcasts, what's your favorite moment as a broadcaster? And this is it. And when I first say 2011 World Series between St. Louis and Texas, sometimes I get, a blank stare or a pause or, I can feel that, you know, they're not right with me on that until I explain it. So a couple of things. This was the first World Series I had ever done. John Miller had done it on ESPN Radio forever, and 2011 was my first World Series. We're in St. Louis, which is such a great place to do baseball, such a great baseball city, as everybody knows. And here's what I try to say to give it some context, and I know you'll appreciate this. There have been three times in the history of Major League Baseball when a team has been one strike away from winning the World Series and has not been able to do it. And two of the three were in that game. Like, if that doesn't tell you what was going on in that game, I don't know what does. So it's the bottom of the ninth, and David Freese is up, and he hits the fly ball to right field. And I'll tell you the first thing going through my mind as a play-by-play guy, that ball, you know, Cruz goes back, and there's some signage on the outfield wall, and I lost the ball for just a fraction of a second. But, like, oh, my God, this is the worst. If he catches it, the Rangers win the World Series. If he doesn't, the game is likely tied. I cannot afford to blow this call. But I lost it for just a second, and that's a terrifying feeling for a play-by-play guy. Fortunately, I guess I'd been around long enough. You just wait, it seems like 10 minutes, but it's a fraction of a second. You find the ball, and you figure out what's going on. He triples. The place goes nuts. They tie the game. People totally forget the 10th inning. Josh Hamilton homers in the top of the 10th. Bottom of the 10th, again, they're down to their final strike. Lance Berkman bounces one up the middle. They tie the game. Score the tying run. And then in the 11th, Freese hits the homer. And to me, it's the Freese game. You know, the triple in the ninth, home run in the 11th. And when I would see David, who, as you know, is an exceedingly nice guy, after that, whether he was still a Cardinal or with the Dodgers, wherever he was, I'm sure three or four times I just, like, as a total goofy, walked up to him and said, hey, David, thanks. That was like the highlight of my career. I'm sure it meant a lot to you, but it was really like the highlight of my career as a broadcaster. And he's so nice. He would just smile and play along. But I don't think my adrenaline has ever been higher in a moment in the broadcast booth than it was in Game 6 of the 2011 World Series.
Dan, when baseball was shut down, we went right into storytelling mode on the podcast. And the first guest that I got to come on in that vein was David Freese.
Oh.
The way his specific memories of that night in those innings, they were incredible. Like how he broke it down from moment to moment to the point. And my favorite thing of all the things that he told me about those innings was when Josh Hamilton gave the Rangers the lead, David standing at third base saying, well, looks like we're going to lose. And you know what? The fact that Josh Hamilton, this incredible story, I'm so glad. Like that would be a really cool ending if we have to lose it. And I thought to myself, you know, to have that perspective, and this is after he tied the game.
Right.
But he, in his mind, is sort of like, well, you know what? That would be a good resolution for someone like Josh Hamilton to have that moment. So that
That's fascinating. Isn't it interesting, too? We've talked about the Bartman game. We've talked about the Freeze game. You know, I know we may talk about the Joe Carter game, which I was at in a different capacity. It's always game six, isn't it? It's fascinating to me. It's always game six where this kind of thing happens. And you know, who knows? Maybe it's some, you know, spooky baseball superstition or higher power we're not aware of, but it always seems to be game six.
Yeah, 1975, 1986.
Yeah, that's right.
On and on. Before we get to the Joe Carter game, 4 years after that that game, you got to do the what's known in Toronto as the bat flip game. Jose Bautista, we had Alex Anthopoulos, the former general manager of the Blue Jays, on recently, and you know he talked about that moment and how that's what everyone recalls from that game. And in the notes you sent me, you didn't even know until the night before that you were going to do that game.
The 1-1. Bautista drives it deep left field. Gone! The Blue Jays dugout has erupted as they greet Bautista at the edge of the track. Suddenly it is 6-3 for Toronto. Unfortunately, there's more debris on the field, and that needs to stop.
Right. So poor Dave Fleming, who is such a great guy and such a great broadcaster. I shouldn't say poor Dave Fleming, but he was doing the Blue Jays Rangers series. I was doing the Cubs and Cardinals, and the Cubs and Cardinals ended in four games the night before what was game five of the Blue Jays and Rangers. And I'm in a cab on the way back to the hotel from Wrigley, and John Martin, who you know very well.
Yep.
John Martin calls me and says, what are you doing tomorrow night? And I said, well, I'm going to the ball. I'm from Toronto, as you know, but for the listeners who don't know, I'm going to the ball game with my kids and my dad. I don't think my mom was going, my kids and my dad. And Chief says, do you want to do the game? And I said, what do you mean do you want to do the game? And he goes, Fleming got pulled off. He's got to do a college football game on TV. We need somebody to do the game in Toronto. And I said, well, of course I'll do the game. So that's how I found out I was doing the game. I think that also got my mom a ticket to the game. She took my ticket. So it was my dad, my mom, and two of my boys who went to the game. So I get home the next morning. I'm trying to cram like I wasn't on that series. And at the time, I wasn't doing Blue Jay games. I knew the Blue Jays well, but I wasn't doing Blue Jay games. I had to cram on Texas. Get to the ballpark. Rick Sutcliffe is the analyst. Terrific. We had a great time. So we're doing the game, and Texas is leading. And then the crazy play in the top of the seventh inning happens when Russell Martin tries to throw the ball back to the mound. It hits Shin-Soo Choo's bat, and I think it was Rougned Odor comes home with the go-ahead run. And I mean, it is ugly, 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 ugly at Rogers Center. Like, I am a very, as you know, a very proud Canadian. It was an ugly moment. As it turns out, they got the call right. Just we didn't know in real time what was going on. But they were throwing bottles, and I could see bottles, plastic bottles, but coming from the top deck above me, landing in the lower deck, like kids down there. And it was really, really ugly. So we get to the seventh inning stretch. And I text my parents and my sons, all four of them, on a group chat, and I say, listen, if they lose the game, I'm afraid what's going to happen outside. I think there might be a riot. Stay wow. in your seats. I will come get you. And I wasn't trying to be melodramatic or anything. It's the ugliest scene I've ever seen in a sporting event. And I said, stay in your seats. You know, my parents are older, and I said, I'll come get you, and we'll figure this out. Then we go to the bottom of the seventh, and you know what happens. Error, and Bautista hits the homer. And I texted them like even before he crossed home plate, and I said, we're good. I'll see you at home, guys. Everything's fine now. And we all met up at home, and everything was okay. But it is the most electrically charged moment I think I've ever been at in a ballpark. The range of emotions from the anger in the top half to the home run in the bottom half. You know, at the time, the Blue Jays hadn't been in the playoffs in 22 years. And there is a feeling among some north of the border that if sports like baseball or basketball get a chance to keep Toronto out, they will, because they don't draw ratings in the U.S. Everybody wants New York, L.A., Chicago. That now, I'm not a subscriber to that theory. I'm just giving you a little backstory on how some people feel up here. So some people felt, well, look at this crazy play, rule against the Blue Jays, keep them out. And, you know, they were upset that most of their games were happening during the day, playoff games, that they weren't getting many primetime slots. Like, there was a lot of emotion, a lot of history, a lot of anger in the ballpark. And then for Bautista to hit the home run. It was like a generation's worth of frustration came out in that moment as Bautista rounded the bases. And isn't it funny how the bat flip was viewed by some as like a sign of the apocalypse? That's less than 5 years ago. And now not only are they tolerated in some circles, they're celebrated. And of course, it was a great, you know, 2 year stretch for the Blue Jays, 15 and 16, a group with a lot of swagger, a lot of personality that gave fans a lot to cheer about.
It's funny, Dan, because I look at that bat flip and I think that was like a turning point in the conversation. I know, you know, Bautista, the way that he did it, it was immediately interpreted as being disrespectful by the Rangers. I just thought he was reacting to this incredible hit in the moment. How did you feel about it?
Well, I didn't see it in the moment. I'm watching the ball. I saw it on replays maybe 30, 60 seconds later. I 100% agree with you then and now. And again, trust me, you know, to all the good folks who are listening to your great podcast, if you were in the ballpark, you would have been at an event unlike any other you had been at. And that's why I tried to give a bit of the backstory about the frustration and the feeling. You know, it was these two teams hated each other. It was the Jays' first time in the playoffs in 22 years. It was unbelievable how much emotion that there was going on in that game. And I know he definitely just reacted in the moment. The network I work for the Blue Jays, Sportsnet, did a watch party of that game a few weeks ago, and some of our Sportsnet hosts were on, and Bautista came on and was asked the very question that you just asked me. And he didn't plan it. He didn't, you know, it was just all that emotion in the moment. And then it got out of hand next year. And I don't want to get into that, but it got out of hand during the regular season between the two teams next year. But, you know, again, you're picking some very fun, memorable moments for me from baseball. And again, when I get asked, like, what games do you remember the most, as a born and raised Toronto guy with my parents and sons at the baseball game, that Bautista bat flip game is right there with David Freese.
Well, we're having some fun with these great memories, and sorry, I'm going to have to bring up a really terrible memory. You had to work with Terry Francona. That must have been.
Tito is one of a kind, and that's an understatement if that's possible. And we only had him for 1 year, as you know, and we all knew that he would go back to managing, and he did. But what a fun ride it was. It was Tito and Oral Hershiser, right? It was Tito and Oral who were together, I believe, that 1 year. And, you know, I got a crash course in Tito in the spring, a number of things, but, you know, getting lost in neighborhoods he'd been in 100 times before. He and I ran out of gas. Again, Claire Smith, her second mention here. Tito and Claire and I are trying to drive back to our hotel. We had a kind of a dinner meeting as a crew. We were down in Fort Myers, and we're driving back up I-75 on the west side, I-75, to get to our hotel, which was maybe 4 exits north, 8-10 miles north. And we ran, Tito's driving, I'm in the passenger seat, and we ran out of gas. And I remember Tito saying, he goes, hey, Shulman, we got a problem. And I go, what's the problem? He goes, we're out of gas. And I said, well, we're like 2 exits away. Like, what's the problem? And he starts like stomping his foot on the gas pedal. And he goes, no, man, you don't understand. We are out of gas. And we coasted off to the side of the freeway. And we got out. Claire got in the front seat to the steering wheel and got on the steering wheel and got behind the steering wheel. And Tito and I are pushing an SUV up I-75 to get it onto the shoulder near an exit. Both sweating buckets, absolutely sweating buckets. And this was, I remember about 100 yards into this, I turned to Tito and I said, hey, Tito, listen, I work with Vital all winter, like, and all kinds of crazy stuff happens, like, all the time. I said, is this what it's going to be like working with you this summer? And he paused and he went, yeah, pretty much, and with a big smile on his face. And he's just, as you know, the most likable, lovable guy that you've ever met. I have never and will never hear anybody say a bad word about Terry Francona. And it was a fun year. You could have done a sitcom on that season.
Oh, no doubt about it. There's so many stories from the year. And all right, last one, the Joe Carter home run. You kind of teased it in the note you sent me. What do you got there?
So this is way back, obviously. I was young. I was 26, and I was the pre- and post-game guy for the Blue Jays radio network. So during the game, I didn't have any responsibilities. So I finished my pregame show. This is game six of the World Series. It's in Toronto. They're up 3-2. So I was in the stands. I got tickets for the game, and I was in the stands down the right field line. And they're losing, going to the bottom of the ninth inning, right? They're losing 6-5 to the Phillies, and if the Phillies win, there's a game seven. And I'm the postgame guy, and at the time, we did our show from the lobby of what was known then as the Sky Dome Hotel. There was and is a hotel out in center field, as a lot of people know there. And we would do a live postgame show from the lobby. It was kind of crazy, actually. And so I'm sitting down the right field line. We go to the bottom of the ninth. The Phillies are leading 6-5. I got to go. Like, I'm on air 2 minutes after last pitch. So there was this freight elevator that we could use because we knew that, you know, the people who operated it. So I kind of went underneath, showed my pass, went underneath the stands, went to the freight elevator. It was the quickest way to get up to the 300 level in center field where the set was. And it's one of these big old elevators, Buster, where you like, you know, the big, you know, metal doors first close from the side and then come top and bottom. You know, it's like you're in a horror movie or something like that. And it stuck. It just stuck for a couple minutes. Something went wrong. And I'm in there. I can't see anything. It's just me and the person who's operating the elevator. And all of a sudden, it's like a volcano erupts. And I know they've won the World Series, but I don't know what's happened because I'm in this elevator. And to this day, I was probably the only one out of 50,000 people at the ballpark that night who didn't see Joe Carter hit a home run to win the World Series. But I've seen it 1,000 times since, obviously, and managed to get up to my radio location and do the postgame show after. But I missed the whole thing.
Did you ever get a chance to tell Joe that story?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, he finds it funny. And you were talking about David Freese and what he remembers. Joe Carter has impeccable memories from that night in 1993 as well, because I've interviewed him about it a lot of times, and he remembers every moment of that at bat. But, yeah, it's I enjoy the story. You know, everybody goes, oh, man, you missed the home run. But you know what? I've gotten 27 years out of a pretty good story out of it. So I'll take the story, and it's, you know, it's fun. It was fun being there again. I was like only 3-4 years out of college. I didn't know what I was doing. And just to be in the ballpark, never mind working on the broadcast for a team that was winning its second consecutive World Series, was tremendous fun. And never could have envisioned, you know, just these moments, you know, getting to relive them with you a little bit. Never could have envisioned being in ballparks or on the college basketball side of my life, being in arenas for some of the great stuff I've been lucky enough to be in. It's been really great.
That's awesome. All right, Dan, these are great stories. I appreciate you helping to distract us for a little bit.
I appreciate you distracting me, Buster. Fun both ways. I hope to see you soon.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Tuesday. Going on with the conversation we had earlier with Jesse Rogers, we got a couple variations of this question. Corey Rukert writes in at CoreyR_12. Are the owners setting the players up to be the bad guys with revenue sharing? Players say yes, they don't get the money they were contractually obligated to. They say no, and there is an outcry from fans upset at millionaire players. What do you think?
Corey, you're right. I wish, as I said to Jesse, I wish they would do this behind closed doors, because the players in the end are going to be the ones who bear the PR hit on this. The whole industry is going to take a hit on this. I wish. Does it, Taylor? I can't think of a reason why they're both sides are doing this so publicly. I don't know how it helps them.
It's very strange. I don't get it. I don't even have words, man. I mean, everyone wants baseball. I mean, this is a once in a lifetime, hopefully, situation here. Like, let's just come together. Let's figure it out. Let's, you know, if you can get the games played, you know, everything else, you know, things could change. Let's do it. But like, to have this knockout, drag out fight in the public is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And I feel like, you know, here on the Baseball Tonight podcast, you know, we've talked a lot about this. There have been some rumblings, but with this plan, like, I'm hearing, you know, just the standard average Joe who likes baseball now talking about it. And now, I mean, my father-in-law the other day was like, these players, they want all this money. Yep. And it's not quite like that, you know?
No, it's more complicated than that, which is why those things should be addressed in privacy and work mm-hmm. it out. Because, as you said, unprecedented situation. There's a checklist of complications. Just work through it. If you actually want to have a chance to play baseball this year, There needs to be collaboration. It can't be the old-fashioned negotiate from two trenches a mile apart and just lob PR shells into the other side. That is not going to play under the current situation. I'm shocked we're in this moment we're in.
Listen to Buster, everyone. Maybe you should mediate these meetings.
Unbelievable.
Last one for today. PK Steinberg writes in, and this was a heavily favorited tweet, so a lot of people want to hear your thoughts on this. They want to know, do you have a favorite ballpark gimmick? Was thinking of something like Star Wars Night, Dog in the Park, Arbor Day. I've seen Game of Thrones Night. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, Dog in the Park days. I love dogs. Like, I've had dogs my whole life. I probably have had like 45 dogs. Growing up on the farm, we always had 3 to 5 dogs running around. Mm-hmm. And so those I love. I remember the first one that I ever saw was in Comiskey Park, I believe, where they had dogs sitting in the outfield. And I was just like, man, I would just love to walk through the outfield and say hello to all of them as I went along and got to meet a whole bunch of new friends.
Oh, it's hilarious. All right. That does it for Bleacher Tweets for today. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And real quick, I edited our Dan Shulman interview earlier, after we recorded and whatnot. But you mentioned David Freeze call being among the best calls you've ever had. But I think you shortchanged his Jose Bautista bat flip call. I mean, he talked all about like all the Canadian subplots to that game. And I feel like he let it all out too. It was not only cathartic in the stadium, but his call felt cathartic too. I liked it a lot.
I'll email him that as we come back. And by the way, before we go, we're going to have when we do announcer night, we're going to have a bit of a surprise for you. He's an announcer, but I'll just say this. He's made his bones in another sport. Very well-known baseball fan. And I got some information. I'm very excited about this interview that we're going to have. For today, my thanks to Jesse and to Dan and to Taylor. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay safe and hang in there.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.